HD Smartcast. You are listening to an HD Smartcast original.
What comes to your mind when I say Tibet? The beautiful Himalayan mountains, the Dalai Lama, or the famous movie 7 Years in Tibet? There are so many books and movies about Tibet. No doubt, they're wonderful, but they're usually not from a Tibetan's perspective. And I need to say this, we're so much more than momos and singing bowls. I don't even confirm if singing bowls are a Tibetan thing. To give you that authentic sense of what Tibet is and what our culture truly is like, we are here once again with Season 2 of Waking Up Closer to Tibet. Hi, I am Fenzin. I am so many things professionally, but at my very core, I am a Tibetan. Join me in this brand new season as I speak to some of the most celebrated Tibetan names who know Tibet in their own unique ways. 10 marvelous episodes with 5 amazing guests. In this season, I will be having the privilege of being in conversation with His Holiness the 14th Dalai Lama, Geshe Thubten Jinpa, Geshe Dorji Damdul, Taichung, and Rekha Gava. So don't forget to tune in every Wednesday as we get, bit by bit, closer to Tibet. Dashi Dili, and welcome back. In case you didn't know, we recently had our new year, and our Tibetan new year is called Losar. This year is the year of Water Rabbit. Each year actually is named after a particular element and an animal, and this year happens to be the year of Water Rabbit. I'm assuming that you already know who our reputable guest is, since I announced it in the previous episode. We have with us our very own esteemed guest, Geshe Thubten Jinpa, who is a celebrated scholar, leader, author, and the principal English translator to His Holiness the 14th Dalai Lama since 1985. He's the founder and president of the Compassion Institute, Tibetan Classics, and also the board chair of the Mind and Life Institute. He has translated and edited numerous books by His Holiness the 14th Dalai Lama, and also has done live translations of His Holiness's speeches. I am so excited and so honored to welcome Geshe Thubten Jinpa. Welcome to CTT, Geshe La. I am so elated to welcome you on the show. Since this show is all about Tibetan Tibetans, I had to have you on. And to be very honest, I am running out of words. I am unable to articulate my words to describe you and your accolades. I can only attempt to, right? So I truly hold you up in high esteem. You are a celebrated scholar, leader, author, and the principal English translator to His Holiness the 14th Dalai Lama since 1985. When you were 6, that was the first time you actually saw His Holiness when he visited the school, right? Your school. So did you ever anticipate being that young boy that one day you would be a principal English translator to His Holiness?
Well, first of all, I would like to thank you, Denzin Chinala, for inviting me and including me among the guests for your podcast. And I love the title, you know, Waking Up Closer to Tibet. You know, as a Tibetan, you know, I really like to see, you know, people across the world, not just in India, appreciate the kind of the more human side of Tibetans and the Tibetan people. So your podcast, with its broad range of covering, you know, varieties of aspects of things Tibetan, I think is a beautiful platform. So as a Tibetan, first let me express my appreciation and thank you to you. Yes, you know, the first time, you know, conscious memory that I can think of seeing His Holiness was when I was around 6 years old in the Tibetan Children's Village in Shimla at the Stirling Castle, which was run by the Save the Children's Fund. Of course, at the time, as a child, you don't really have any idea what future looks like. But looking back, it looks like that formal meeting with His Holiness must have been quite auspicious, because I was told by the teachers and foster parents at the time that one of the things that I asked His Holiness was, can I become a monk? So I don't know what went into my head at the age of six, asking His Holiness, can I become a monk? And His Holiness apparently told me, yes, if you study hard, you can become a monk anytime. So clearly, a karma was established at the time, which would lead me then to become a monk, join a monastery. And my formal education really has been in the classical Tibetan monastic system, which then, set me in a completely different trajectory of life and path compared to many other Tibetan children of my generation. But I, of course, would have never imagined, I will ever get to a point where I will be in this position to serve His Holiness in a formal way as His principal interpreter. There's just no way I could have imagined.
It's incredible. I think it's truly incredible the way things turn out for you. Of course, a lot of hard work that goes into it, but also, as you said, a lot of karmic connection as well, right?
Sure. Yes. I mean, I actually, one of the things that I've come to learn is that, many of us like to think we have some control over our life and we make plans. We deeply believe we are rational creatures. We can plan ahead. We can make choices. But in the end, there is something very profound about the Indian and Tibetan idea of karma, because in the end, many of the important things that really impact your life, like your life's decision, for example, like the career direction that you end up choosing, the important life partner that you end up marrying and having children, starting a family with, many of these, you don't really make a choice. They just happen. But you just need to create the right conditions, So in my case, one of the most important impacts in my life has been having the opportunity to serve His Holiness as His principal interpreter. But I never rationally planned for it. I was a monk in South India, and it just so happened I happened to be in Dharamsala. And then they were looking for someone who could translate, stand by for the translator for the first day. And I happened to be one of the young monks who had some facility with English, which then led to me being the translator on that day, which then opened up a completely different path in my life for which I never planned. So I think that, we, as much as we like to think that we can plan, make important decisions, but we also need to be ready and receptive when important opportunities arise in our life. That's one thing I've learned, yeah.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, Buddhism is central to our culture, and we strive to study it. We strive to practice its core values. Historically, ancient Buddhist texts laid impetus for the study of Buddhism, right? I mean, without these texts, we wouldn't be able to study Buddhism, right? It is believed that after the parinirvana of Gautama Buddha, the Sangha became the guardian of these texts. Yeah. And many volumes were lost. Some manuscripts were withered away with tumultuous climatic conditions. To what extent is this true? Because it seems like a complete mystery to me.
Well, actually, you're right that when Buddha passed away, the custodianship of the teachings that he gave, which is referred to as Dharma. Dharma is a generic term that is used in both Hinduism and Buddhism, as well as in Jainism. In the Indian traditions, use that important word, which has a multiple meaning. But in the Buddhist context, Buddha's collection of Buddha's teaching is referred to as Dharma, Chö, in Tibetan. So, of course, when Buddha passed away, the custodianship of the body of teaching was passed on to the Sangha, the community, especially headed by the senior monks. But historians now and the scholars now tell us that actually the teachings were not written down for a long time. They were oral in nature. So, and there is some indications of that. If you look at the very, very early sutras, the scriptures that are attributed to the Buddha, there is an oral nature to them. There's a lot of refrains, like in a song, you have refrains and repetitions, and there are props which allow you to remember the next sequence. So I think the historians and scholars are right that the texts were not written down. And that was not just in the case of Buddhism. It was the same for the Vedic texts and Jaina texts and other, you know, Brahmanical traditions of India. The writing of texts, because many of the texts that were considered to be sacred were kept oral. And there were monastic members who were appointed to memorize it and passed on. So the text came to be written down several hundred years after Buddha's death. But yes, of course, in India, because of the monsoon and all of this, and especially, you know, after the 13th century, Buddhism kind of gradually disappeared from India. So monasteries got destroyed. Vikramalashila and Nalanda, they became just a name and in fact actually went out of Indian memory as well. But Buddhism shifted to Tibet. But I would say that most of the important scriptures that are attributed to the Buddha are still extant. They are not lost. Because Buddhism, you know, the early version of Buddhism also went to Sri Lanka quite early before the Common Era during the King Ashoka. So, and these texts are now kept as part of the Pali canon. So I would say the most important, the core teachings of the Buddha have not been lost. But among the later Indian thinkers like Nagarjuna and, you know, Asanga and Vasubandhu, so many of their texts, the original texts in Sanskrit were lost. But fortunately, you know, many of them, most of them have been translated into Tibetan. So we have the Tibetan versions of these Indian, great Indian classics. And some of the Sanskrit originals were rediscovered in Tibet because Tibet is high, dry, or, you know, high altitude, dry climate, beyond monsoon. So it's almost like a kind of a desert atmosphere. So the text, even written on palm leaves, which is the Indian original style of writing, which was not on paper, it was on palm leaves. Some of these texts were survived in Tibet, and they were rediscovered by Shankara Rahula, who came to Tibet in the beginning of the 20th century to look for Sanskrit texts. So some of these have been restored or recovered. But on the whole, I think most of the key Buddhist texts are still extant. Yeah, so I don't think we need to worry too much about that.
Okay.
Thanks largely to, especially for the Mahayana text, thanks largely to the Tibetans, actually.
Yes. So hopefully we've not lost something extremely precious. Because, I mean, the existing texts, if they're so rich and we treasure it so much, imagine what could have been in these volumes that we may have lost.
Yeah, right. And quite a few were lost, but then, of course, as a Buddhist, we have to take seriously the law of impermanence. Nothing lasts too long, so too much attachment is probably not a good idea, even to your own dharma and tradition, you know?
Yes, touche. Yes, and also I think one of the barriers could also be the factors would be, for example, when Gautama Buddha would give his teachings, right? The disciples, they may have their own interpretation. For example, if Buddha is saying something, you know, he's teaching something, but the disciple may interpret that as something else and may add in his or her perspective. So what is your perspective on that, on the formulation of texts back then? Could that have been possible?
Yes, definitely. In fact, right from the very, very early stages of Buddhism, there was a recognition that there is a diversity to Buddha's teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And the understanding was that many of these diverse teachings, some of which actually seem to be contradictory on the surface, were given with a specific intention for a specific purpose to different audiences. So, in fact, there is a beautiful metaphor used in one of the Indian texts where Buddha's teaching is compared to medicine. And medicine, you cannot say this is the best medicine for all.
Right.
It has to be appropriate to the specific illness. Mm. And also you need to take into account the constituency of the patient to whom you are prescribing. So one medicine may be good at the right and what time, but the same medicine may not be good in another time. So there is this recognition that there is no such thing as one, the Dharma. There are teachings which are appropriate and useful and beneficial for specific individuals in specific contexts. So this diversity and multiplicity of Buddha's teaching was recognized quite early. And also one of the important things that we have to keep in mind is that unlike other traditions, Buddhism is not a religion of the book. So therefore, for example, like if you look at Islam or, you know, Christianity or Judaism, they are referred to as the religion of the book. So, and also for the Vedic traditions in India, Veda is a sacred scripture. There's a side to it. We can say it's a religion of the book, but Buddhism isn't. So I think this is something that we have to keep in mind. So I don't think the Buddhist tradition on the whole really worried too much about there being diverse interpretations of the teaching of their master. In fact, you know, diverse interpretations is seen as a celebration of the beneficial nature of Buddha's teaching. Because if the Buddha's teaching has to be read only in one unilateral way, it may not benefit so many diverse needs of the disciples. So multiple interpretation is not an issue in the Buddhist tradition.
Mm-hmm. Right. As long as it benefits people, right?
Yes. Mm.
Correct. So you're the founder and president of the Compassion Institute, Tibetan Classics, and also the board chair of the Mind and Life Institute. Please enlighten us a little about your endeavors and what your vision is for the future being in these roles.
Well, the Institute of Tibetan Classics is the one initiative that I myself began. And it's the aim of the Institute is quite humble, I can say, but also quite ambitious in one way. So the aim is to really compile together a list of key classical Tibetan texts that would cover the entire spectrum of classical Tibetan discipline of knowledge, from teachings of the Dharma of different traditions like Sakya Nyingma, Kagyu Gelug, Chonang, Pon, up to Tibetan medicine, Tibetan astrosciences, Tibetan opera, poetry, philosophy, psychology, Abhidharma. So the aim is to have a collection in a manageable number of 32 large volumes that would represent the entire spectrum of classical Tibetan knowledge and disciplines. And these are well curated and then published as a series, first in Tibetan, using modern methodology of introduction, bibliography, paragraph, and all of that. So in a sense, I'm reformatting these texts. And then later, then translating the whole thing into English, which is quite a costly endeavor because they're expensive. So that's my main. And the aim is to really make this body of knowledge and text part of the global heritage, you know, intellectual and spiritual heritage, so that language should not be a barrier for anyone to have access to them. So that's basically my main kind of initiative and effort. But for Mind and Life, you know, I'm in a sense, in my own humble way, trying to fulfill His Holiness the Dalai Lama's aspiration for the organization, which he co-founded. Mm. And the aim of Mind and Life is to really catalyze conversation between and collaboration between the science and contemplative traditions, particularly the Buddhism, both with respect to understanding the nature and function of human mind, as well as, you know, development of mental training programs that can emerge from this, which can be then universalized so that could be beneficial. Today we see, for example, like applications of mindfulness, loving kindness meditation, compassion training meditation, all of this quite widely in the world. So many of these can be seen as consequences or fruits coming out of these initiatives represented by Mind and Life Institute. And it's a platform. Mind and Life Institute offers a platform where scholars from both humanities fields as well as research and basic science can come into contact with Buddhist scholars and philosophers and so on. The Compassion Institute is an aim. Again, I'm trying to bring into reality some of His Holiness's aspirations to really make compassion a kind of an active force in the world, not just as a philosophy of life, not just as a beautiful value to admire, but actually making it real. How can we bring compassion as part of our intention in our everyday work? What would it look like, say, for example, for the physicians to take compassion seriously as part of their ethos and practically apply it in their patient interaction and, you know, treatment? What would it look like for law enforcement officers like police to take compassion seriously and use the recognition of basic humanity of everybody as the foundation from which they can perceive and relate to others? So the Compassion Institute is really aimed at trying to see if this vision of His Holiness, where He likes to see compassion play an active role, not just in individuals' own personal life, for which we have a lot of research showing there is a huge amount of benefits for people who take compassion seriously themselves from point of view of health, longevity, and so on. But what it would mean to actually bring it at the societal level, to adapt it, to apply it, to develop it, to research it. And so that's the aim of Compassion Institute. And I had the privilege to develop an 8-week compassion formal training course at Stanford called CCT, Compassion Cultivation Training. And so we, through the Institute, we actually train the instructors who can offer this eight-week course. And the 8-week course is for general public, but the Institute itself is now exploring ways to adapt it. And we have quite an ongoing program, both in the healthcare domain, dealing with the problem of physician burnout, using compassion as a key method.
Okay.
And also law enforcement officers, as well as K-12 teacher training, bringing compassion in a formal way. So these are initiatives that the Compassion Institute, has undertaken. And from my own personal point of view, the aim here is to, again, make real in some way His Holiness's noble vision for the world. Yeah.
That's beautiful. We so need this. I think the world so needs this right now because, I mean, we're living in the age of digital extravaganza where our attention spans have been almost diminished. I mean, we can't even watch a video for like 5 minutes. This has happened to our mind and this has happened to our brain. What's really intriguing about our mind, Yeshila, and I think you may agree on this, is the fact that the brain is a physical place, but the mind is a non-physical place. You can't even touch or feel it, but it's like so complicated. And today we're speaking of, I mean, we have more roundtable conferences. I mean, you've played a very pivotal role in bridging that relationship and, you know, encouraging dialogue between Buddhism and science. Yeah. Where today we have more roundtables, you know, discussing about neuroplasticity than ever before. How, as you mentioned, compassion and practicing meditation can improve our mental health and our health in general, especially people with depression, people with anxiety, and even bipolar in many cases. Oh. So, what is your perspective on this?
Well, I think one of the very important insights that Buddhism in particular, but Indian tradition in general, has brought to this conversation is the important role our own mind can play in our well-being. Because in the West, until recently, you know, the science was completely dominated by material paradigm. So even when they're thinking about human experience, you know, scientists tend to think purely in terms of the physical brain.
Yes.
And this happens, this chemical kind of lights up, you know, this kind of brain regions get activated. It's all from a brain perspective. But from the brain perspective, although neuroscience is getting very, very deep in its insights, but in the end, the brain language is not going to be helpful for average person. Hmm. You know, what does it mean for my brain doing X, Y, and Z? Whereas if we are able to develop the mind side of the language, you know, attention, cognition, awareness, rumination, thought, fear, anxiety, those are all mind side of the language. So if we develop the rich mind side of the language, then there is a chance for ordinary people to apply that in their everyday life. And the mind side of the language is where Indian tradition in general and Buddhism in particular is very, very rich. And one of the fundamental insights that the Buddha has brought to us is the importance of mind, turning your mind into your own ally. Because Buddha has said that you're your own master, and for the same reason, you can be your own worst enemy. So the mind is something that is always with us. We cannot avoid, you know, our mind. Mind, it doesn't really matter. Even if you take a break, go to the beach and try to relax, if you can't relax your mind,
right,
you know, there's not much relaxation you're going to have. So one of the things that the Indian tradition and Buddhism in particular is trying to bring to the conversation is to say, okay, you know, we can, by cultivating our attentional capacity, awareness, bringing awareness to our own emotion, we can actually bring some discipline to our mind so that we can apply our mind in a more conscious way. And through application, for example, like, you know, mindfulness has been shown to be powerfully effective in treatment of depression. Not the first time, you know, when you first have it. When you first experience it, you need medication. But one of the biggest problems is the relapse. But mindfulness meditation has been shown to be powerful in prevention of relapse. And that's because mindfulness technique teaches us to be able to observe, you know, kind of dispassionately our own mind and emotions without judgment. And then if you're able to do that, this is called meta awareness. It's in a second level awareness. So when you're able to observe your own mind and thoughts, then you can keep a distance so that you don't get sucked into the energy of that spiraling nature of thought. Because when ruminations kick in, you start worrying, oh, I sent an email, he did not reply, maybe he's angry with me. And then once you start thinking that, your mind starts giving you all the stories of why it is possible that he's angry with me, you know. So it's then you go through that spiral. And so what mindfulness technique does is to allow you to observe and catch yourself. So when you catch yourself, you don't give the rumination the fuel or the energy to keep going, like a kind of a dog chasing after its own tail kind of thing. So in this way, through attentional training, through training of awareness, and then especially if we bring compassion as an intention, being kindness as our approach, then you begin to see how His Holiness's, you know, insistence on using mental training as a key to one's own mental well-being power can be powerful and make sense. And this is where I think the Indian tradition in general and Buddhism in particular has really made significant contribution to today's, you know, this contemplative practice and contemplative studies world, where, you know, even in the business and leadership training, people are now talking about mindfulness and compassion. You know, I mean, of course, 10 or 20 years ago, nobody would even think those kind of language has place in such context. But now even police officers are talking about mindfulness and compassion. You know, so physicians are beginning to talk about how to use mindfulness. So we really see this, and this is a great contribution from, you know, the Indian tradition and Buddhism in particular, and primarily through the medium of Tibetan tradition, because the Tibetan Buddhism is essentially the continuation of the Indian Nalanda tradition. That's what His Holiness keeps, you know, explaining to us, because Buddhism disappeared in India around the 13th, 14th century. But by that time, it was well established in Tibet, and the Tibetans kept going, you know, built up major monastic universities, which were modeled on Nalanda and Vikramashila. Most of the Indian key texts, Buddhist texts, were translated. The same curriculum that was being studied in Nalanda was replicated in Tibet, and monastic universities were doing debate and writing text. So now, in some sense, you know, His Holiness likes to refer to Tibetans as chela, the students, disciples, and India as the guru. Now the Tibetans, the chelas, are bringing Indians' own rich tradition back to India.
Yes.
And I think, you know, this is something that I hope not just Tibetans, but also Indians would take pride in, the fact that this is a major contribution from the Indian tradition.
True, true. I think we can break free from the shackles of negative pattern of thinking. It is difficult. I mean, it's not going to be easy for sure. especially with people with genetic, you know, something that they inherit, so even bipolar for that matter, right? In many cases, it's something that you inherit genetically. So it's very difficult, but with proper training and with proper guidance, I believe there is hope that there is light at the end of the tunnel for us.
For kind of, you know, serious medical conditions, I think pharmacological approach has to be key.
Yes.
But where mental training can really help is to provide an ability to self-regulate and calm themselves down. So this is where the yogic practices, the yoga and, you know, mindfulness-based breathing exercises, you know, just being able to catch yourself and calm yourself down. And we see that in children. When children, especially in between the age 2 to 4, they get so frustrated, and it's known as the famous, you know, temper tantrums, you know, terrible twos, as it is called. But when you teach them breathing techniques, they are able to calm themselves down. You know, so I think where mental training exercises can really help is not so much treat the illness for which you need medical help, but actually it helps you manage it by providing tools to bring awareness, self-regulate and calm, so that once you're calmer mentally, then even the medical treatment becomes more effective. So I think this is where I think combination of ancient techniques like mindfulness and compassion with modern, you know, medical treatment is really, even for the medical conditions, I think it's going to be quite effective. Yeah.
This is part one of our conversation with Geshe Thubten Jinpa, and I'm already excited for part two of our conversation, because Geshe La is someone who's very knowledgeable about not only Tibetan Buddhism, but also as someone who's mastered the art of translation. There are so many interesting topics that we will be talking about in the next episode. So please make sure you tune in to our part two of our conversation with Geshe Thubten Jinpa. I will see you very soon then. Take care, and together, bit by bit, let's get closer to Tibet. If you like this episode, then please support this podcast by sharing it with your loved ones. You can give me a shout out and mention me in your Instagram stories and posts. My Instagram handle is tenzin.chijin.24. That is tenzin.chodon.24. To stay updated about Waking Up Closer to Tibet podcast, don't forget to follow HD Smartcast on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and Instagram. To listen to more podcasts, log on to hdsmartcast.com or suno naye nazariye se.
This was an HD Smartcast original.
HD Smartcast.